I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. We are on Radio Row, the same floor as the concession stands at the Wells Fargo Center in South Philadelphia. This, of course, the site of the DNC. And what is Radio Row? Well, it's a collection of tables essentially jammed together with just enough room for a few chairs and some mics. Over my shoulder is NPR. I am inches from engineer Adam Staniszewski, producer Debbie Builder across from me, in touch with our team at WHYY. Emily Bryant on my left, checking out email and calls and Twitter, and John Ahrens and Liz Fiedler on the floor. Well, on Saturday, Hillary Clinton picked Tim Kaine to be her running mate. Who is this guy who was a mayor, a lieutenant governor, a governor, head of the Democratic National Convention, and now Virginia senator? Jim Nolan joins us across from me here at Radio Row. He reports for Richmond Times-Dispatch. In fact, used to report for the Philadelphia Daily News. You can check him out at richmond.com. And, Jim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
You know, it's so interesting. On whatever day that Hillary Clinton announced that Tim Kaine was going to be her running mate, there was a sort of collective shrug, I think, among a lot of progressive Democrats and even maybe some Democrats. And then when he spoke on Saturday afternoon, I think a lot of people kind of perked up and said, oh, who is this guy, Tim Kaine? He looks like an interesting guy and not boring. Where did this boring thing come from?
I think Tim Kaine likes to think of people thinking of him as boring.
Why?
I kind of like to describe him as the vice president next door. He's been in Richmond for 30 years. He moved there to marry the daughter of former Virginia Governor Linwood Holton, whom he met in law school at Harvard, from which he took a year sabbatical to work as a Catholic missionary in Honduras. And that's where he learned Spanish, which, for anyone who was watching the speech in Miami, was essentially how he started his remarks to that largely Hispanic crowd. Estamos listos para Hillary Clinton. And people were asking, estamos listos para Tim Kaine. And Tim Kaine has been a very successful politician in Richmond. He started from the ground floor. He was a city councilman, and then he was elected by the council to serve as mayor, left office on September 10th, right before 9/11, and pursued a lieutenant governor's job as Mark Warner's running mate. And that came about by a very interesting twist of fate. Emily Couric, the sister of Katie Couric, had become very, very ill, and she essentially gave her support to Tim Kaine in that race. Tim Kaine won a contested LG primary and then went on to become LG when Mark Warner became the governor. And that kind of solidified his place as a prominent number two. From there, of course, he ran for governor, was elected in 2005, served 2006 to 2010. And then another interesting quirk of fate happened politically. Senator Jim Webb, the one-term senator who had defeated George Allen, decided that he was not going to seek a second term. And President Obama asked his good friend Tim Kaine, who had been the runner-up in 2008, to pick up the pieces and try and hold the seat for Democrats, which he did by defeating George Allen.
Wow.
And that's how we get here today.
And at one point, I think President Obama was thinking about Tim Kaine as a possible vice presidential running mate. Obviously, he didn't get the job.
I was, I think I was with Tim Kaine when he got that phone call.
Oh, really?
And he took it very, very well, as far as I could tell. But certainly, I think in 2008, it was clear that Tim Kaine was the heart choice of President Obama. Joe Biden was the head choice. A lot of people thought Tim Kaine did not have the foreign policy experience. But then Tim Kaine did something very interesting. He started working on his foreign policy credentials. He became a member of the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees. He's traveled extensively. He's taken positions on the War Powers Act and has really built up his credentials so that now a lot of people, when they were thinking about the Veep stakes, were saying, well, maybe Tim Kaine's the head choice for Hillary Clinton.
Head and heart. He is a Catholic, and I've heard some people say, think about liberation theology. I mean, that kind of Catholicism where you're working as a missionary in Central America. Should we think of his faith that way?
I don't don't know that I would think of it that way. I think Tim Kaine has viewed his public life as a something of a crusade, if we want to dip into theological terms, for social justice. I think being in Honduras changed his life, changed him as a person. And I think he came back seeing an opportunity through public office to do public service. And I think that's how he likes to define himself. There's been a lot of talk this week, especially from the Sanders quarters, about Kaine not having progressive values. And certainly you can look at a couple of his positions on perhaps trade and energy and say that maybe there's some indication there. And he also is personally opposed to abortion and the death penalty as a Catholic, but he has not taken any steps in either public forum to restrict the rights of women or to hold up an execution that was lawfully scheduled.
Well, it's interesting. I believe Planned Parenthood gives him A+ or 100% support. So while he personally opposes abortion, he gets support from Planned Parenthood.
There's no question about it. And I think I was talking to him not too long ago, and he was essentially saying, look, for the first time, a lot of people didn't know who I was. And the first time many of them heard about me was in Miami. But if they did, they'll see, hey, I was a civil rights lawyer. I advocated for fair housing in Richmond when I first got there. He did a lot of things. Even his wife, Ann Holton, was among the first white children to go to previously segregated Richmond schools when she was living in the governor's mansion as the daughter of Linwood Holton. So the family has progressive values. Tim Kaine hasn't talked about them a lot. And I imagine what you're going to see is an effort in the coming weeks to demonstrate more of his progressive cred, as you will.
Well, he does go to, as I understand it, a largely African-American church. I don't know, is that a long-standing practice that he and his family have had?
Only 30 years, Mark.
Only 30 years.
He's lived in the same house for at least 20 years, and he's very close. He has a lot of rituals that he follows. He did family camping trips, neighbor hiking trips. The friends Tim Kaine had and made when he was a young lawyer and city councilman in Richmond are the same friends and social partners that he has now. And that really hasn't changed. Of course, every once in a while, you've got to go to the White House for something.
Absolutely.
But Tim Kaine has kept his friends close, and they're still part of his life. In fact, this morning, he went to his favorite diner in Richmond and had breakfast with some of his old pals.
How does he get along with Republicans? And I don't know how split Virginia is or just how contentious the politics are there.
Well, Virginia, from a statewide and national level, as you know, has become closer to a blue state than it ever had before. President Obama's victory was earth-shattering for Virginia, which hadn't gone Democratic since 1964. But the state legislature is controlled by Republicans, largely due to recent gerrymandering that made districts very favorable to Republicans. So Tim Kaine had to deal with a Republican legislature when he was in office. And there aren't going to be a lot of people who say a lot was accomplished during that time. However, he did find ways to work with them on a couple of issues. Open space preservation, they preserved over 400,000 acres in Virginia, including some Civil War battlefields. And he also worked with them on a smoking ban. It's hard to go into a restaurant now and smell smoke. It just doesn't happen anymore. And Virginia, which is the home of tobacco, was certainly one of the holdouts for that. And Kaine managed to work with the Republican leadership to get that enacted in Virginia. And that was a fairly significant public health step.
It's also the home of the NRA, as he reminded us. Not a friendly relationship between Tim Kaine and the NRA.
Well, I don't think Tim Kaine is opposed to firearms. I think my sense is that he's opposed to the unrestricted purchase and use of firearms. And certainly he has a historical backdrop to have that increase that has nothing to do with the recent events that we've been experiencing. In 2007, in April, Virginia Tech experienced one of the worst mass shootings.
He talked about that with a great deal of emotion.
And he was in Japan on a trade mission at the time. He had just landed when he got word of the Tech shootings and immediately boarded a plane to return home. and gave one of the best speeches I've ever heard a politician give to the grieving, to the Tech student body, to the community at large. And I think from that emerged a sense that there needs to be some way to, at least from the mental health standpoint, find a better way to regulate firearms. So that's not even, that might not endear him to the NRA, but it's going to endear him to a lot of Democrats and other progressives.
How do you think he'll be as a debater? There will be, assuming he gets the job, but I don't think that's in question, but as a debater, there will be one vice presidential debate in the fall. He seems like a nice guy, although he certainly was critical of Donald Trump when he spoke on Saturday afternoon.
So a couple of things about that debate. It's at Longwood University, so it's kind of home field advantage for Tim Kaine. It's just, Longwood is in Farmville, Virginia, which is in the south side of Virginia, yeah. So he'll have a home field advantage. The other thing is, I like to think of Tim Kaine, if he were part of a crime series, I'd call him the icicle killer. Because you'd find a body on the ground in a puddle of water, and you wonder how the person died. And I think Tim Kaine's style might take
people... No fingerprints, you're telling
exactly.
us.
Exactly. Tim Kaine's style might be all gee whiz and golly, and this is a great treat, and what fun this will be, and I sure hope I'm going to do well. But underneath that genial, happy warrior is a guy who knows how to fight. Just remember, he hasn't lost an election. And Virginia politics is a contact sport. He is a very good debater, and anybody who underestimates him does so at their peril. He's going to be more of a handful than I think most people realize, because he seems like such a nice guy. In fact, people wonder, can he fulfill the role of attack dog that traditional vice presidential candidates assume?
Saying he can.
I think he'll do it, but in a different way. And on some level, the civility of his approach to politics won't mask the fact that he's very competitive.
We're almost out of time here. Assuming he gets the job, the governor, Terry McAuliffe, does he then appoint someone to take Tim Kaine's place? And are there names being floated already?
As the current governor said, a lot of people have been approaching him.
I mean, they have, right.
Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat, will get the chance to appoint someone to fill the term until 2017, when Virginia has a statewide election. Then Tim Kaine's full term is up in 2018. So whomever McAuliffe appoints will not only have to win in 2017, but will also have to win in 2018. And the governor, I think, has plans to federalize that election should he and the Democrats prevail in November.
Well, on that note, Jim Nolan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Welcome back to Philadelphia.
Great to be here.
And he's a reporter with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. You can check it out at richmond.com. We're going to take a very short break, and after the short break, we'll be talking with Kyle Kopko about vice presidents and do home states matter and much, much more. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are on Radio Row at the Democratic National Convention at the Wells Fargo Center in South Philadelphia. You probably know that by now. There's been a lot going on in the city in the last 24 hours. We have been covering it and also featuring interviews with folks who have been stopping by and setting up guests as well. In fact, joining us now is Kyle Kopko, and he is associate professor at Elizabethtown College. Wrote a book called The Vice President Advantage. And Kyle Kopko, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. I just said goodbye to Jim Nolan. He has been covering Tim Kaine in Virginia for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Based on what you know about Tim Kaine, what's your takeaway?
I think that he was a good choice, particular particularly for governing. Tim Kaine, as Jim Nolan mentioned, he has a wealth of political experience. His service as lieutenant governor certainly primes him to serve as a supporting role. Given that he has executive experience, he has experience in the United States Senate, chairing the DNC, he knows a lot of folks in politics. He could potentially serve as president if the occasion ever called for it, and that should be the number one criteria when selecting a running mate.
Well, I wonder, there was so much speculation leading up to both Donald Trump picking his vice president and Hillary Clinton picking hers. Do we overemphasize this selection of vice president?
From an electoral standpoint, that's often the case. That's not to say that vice presidential candidates are totally irrelevant whenever it comes to a campaign. But there tends to be times whenever reporters and pundits make some pretty outlandish comments about the influence of running mates, almost as if they're just as important as presidential candidates. But all the available evidence seems to point to a pretty obvious conclusion that presidential candidates are the most influential factor in these elections, and that's what voters look to primarily when they go to the voting booth.
Does it, though? I mean, in certain ways, it is the first sort of most high-profile decision that a candidate makes. Does it tell us something about the candidate for the presidency?
Indeed, it does. And you're exactly right. Whenever a presidential candidate selects a running mate, this is a signal to the voters. This is really their first presidential action. They're saying, this is the person who would succeed me in the event of an unforeseen situation. It also signals their priorities. So what has this running mate done in their political career? What are they most known for? This is going to be their chief policy advisor, too. The office of the vice president has gained more influence as a governing institution in recent decades. And so because of that, it serves as an opportunity to help the president advance policy and legislation, work with members on Capitol Hill. So in that regard, it does send an important message to voters, but it's not as influential as many people would seem.
When did it become a more important job?
It's a great question. There's actually a wonderful book by a law professor by the name of Joel Goldstein at St. Louis University that just came out last year called The White House Vice Presidency, and he examines this issue. Some folks would say Richard Nixon, whenever he was vice president under President Eisenhower, he took a more of an active role in overseeing policy issues. Professor Goldstein seems to point to Walter Mondale in the Carter administration. Jimmy Carter set up the practice of having weekly meetings with his vice president, involving them in cabinet meetings, National Security Council meetings. And since that time, we see vice presidents steadily taking on more and more responsibilities over the years.
And that's Kyle Kopko, associate professor of at Elizabethtown College, wrote a book called The Vice President. Is it The Vice Presidential Advantage? I'm sorry.
Advantage. That's all right.
The VP Advantage. I'm sorry. I was shorthanding your book here. And you can join the conversation. How important do you think the decision made by Hillary Clinton and last week by Donald Trump announcing their vice presidents? Selection for vice president, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or do you not care at all, which I think is a totally legitimate question. Going back to you, Kyle, what did you then make Governor Pence of Indiana when Donald Trump chose him to be his vice president?
It wasn't terribly surprising to me. My co-author, Chris Devine, and I, we were paying close attention to this, and we had written on this topic to some extent about the need to balance the ticket, particularly reinforcing campaign messages and statements over the course of the past few months. And Donald Trump has come out time and time again saying that he wanted to find someone who had that Washington insider experience. And obviously, as many listeners know, Donald Trump has had no experience in elected office before. He briefly ran for president before in 1999-2000 as a Reform Party candidate. But that's the extent of his political experience. So he doesn't have intimate knowledge of working with members of Congress, drafting legislation, anything of that sort. So someone like Mike Pence has a dozen years of experience in the House of Representatives, also executive experience as governor of Indiana. That seemed to fit the profile of what he was looking for. And I think, too, that it helped to reassure some skeptical voters within the Republican Party and the conservative base of the Republican Party, because Mike Pence is a well-known evangelical and socialist conservative, and folks still have some concerns about Trump's policy positions.
Do vice presidents, do they deliver their home state? Is that a guarantee?
It's not a guarantee at all, and it's often exaggerated based upon the data that we put forward in our book. It can happen, but it's exceedingly rare. We even find evidence that it can matter, but only when a running mate comes from a relatively small state and they have a great deal of political experience as an elected official within that state. So think of them as a political institution. Is this someone who's so beloved and so well respected that they're going to be able to reach out to their neighbors and change their hearts and minds and say, you know what, you really ought to consider voting for my ticket because I know this presidential candidate. You got to trust me on this. It's going to be a great fit. It's really tough to do that in a large, diverse state with so many different political cultures and cleavages and things of that nature. We find someone like Joe Biden, based on the data, delivering a home state advantage. Edmund Muskie from 1968, former senator and governor of Maine, was able to deliver a home state advantage. Problem being, small states have fewer electoral college votes. So the odds of them influencing the presidential election's outcome, pretty small.
Is that because in many ways, I mean, people I think sometimes forget it's the Electoral College. I mean, we had a bit of a civics lesson this year as there were primaries and caucuses across the country. But do you think in many ways people think of a run for the White House as a national election rather than really one that's won and campaigned on state by state?
You know, it's tough because we do polls at a national level. So in some regards, we're thinking about them almost in terms of the popular vote. But then whenever it comes to actually discussing electoral strategy, we're constantly talking about battleground states and state strategies. And I think in particular, that's one of the reasons why Tim Kaine's name floated up to the top of the list in some news media reports, because a lot of folks realize that Virginia is going to be a battleground state, something that's going to be very important this time around, and any political connections there could potentially help the Clinton campaign. But it's really tough to tell. It really depends on who you're talking to.
Well, Pennsylvania, you're in Pennsylvania, as are we. Pennsylvania also being described as a battleground state. And some thinking that Hillary Clinton needed, if I can put it this way, a white centrist or moderate centrist male to appeal to some of these disaffected voters in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. And certainly that's been the perception. But based on the data analysis that we do in our book, my co-author Christopher Devine and I, we found that vice presidents can influence the national vote at the margins. And this should apply consistently across the board in various states. But here's the issue. Presidential candidates, their ratings by voters, their perceived value, carries three times the weight compared to vice presidential running mates. So what that means then is if a vice presidential candidate is really going to move the needle one way or another, they really have to be exceedingly popular or unpopular relative to the presidential candidate. Would that work in Tim Kaine's case? I'm skeptical. I'll certainly look at the data after the election, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
Well, there was a lot of speculation. Of course, some people even speculating a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, Tom Perez, Julian Castro. I don't know if you need to run your data to sort of figure out how they might have played out, but anything that strikes you about those potential candidates? Obviously, Hillary Clinton's chose somebody else.
Sure. This past weekend, my co-author and I, we just published a piece in the Washington Post blog, The Monkey Cage, about demographic appeals. And we certainly have never had, say, a Latino vice presidential candidate for a major political party. So we're just going to have to wait and see there. And will Tim Kaine's ability to speak Spanish help to motivate Latino voters? We'll just have to see. But what we can do is look back at other demographic characteristics, like was a running mate Catholic? Was a running mate female? Was a running mate Jewish? And based upon data going back to the 1970s, what we find is that voters within these demographic groups, they generally like these vice presidential candidates more. So women liked Geraldine Ferraro more. They liked Sarah Palin more. They liked Joe Lieberman more if they were Jewish. They liked Sergeant Schreiber more if they were Catholic. But it doesn't translate into votes necessarily. It's a different story for presidential candidates. Catholics were much more likely to turn out for John F. Kennedy. African Americans were much more likely to vote for Barack Obama. So again, it fits this pattern that we've seen in our research over and over again, that typically it's the presidential candidates having the most influence, and it's pretty rare that a vice presidential candidate will influence vote choice at the mass level.
You mentioned religion, and we know from some of the WikiLeaks that came out, there was some question that some of the members of the DNC raised about Bernie Sanders' Jewish religion or whether or not he was some kind of an atheist or not. Of course, the DNC getting in hot water, including the head of the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Is religion a salient issue or message in 2016?
It can be. It certainly can be. And I know that at least on the Republican side, too, more evangelicals are supporting Trump than not. Depending on how the DNC handles this flap over Sanders' religions, will fewer Jewish voters turn out for the Democrats this time around? A lot really depends on how much responsibility they claim for this, whether their apology is well received, but this is all identity politics. So it matters to some extent, but there's a lot of campaigning to happen in the next few months, and I think other issues will crop up between now and then.
Can you explain why evangelicals support Donald Trump?
That's been a steady trend, actually, over the past few election cycles, where evangelicals have aligned themselves with the Republican Party, you know, ever since the formation of the Moral Majority and the Reagan administration, really. So this just tends to be a social identity voting bloc, even though the sometimes policy positions of Donald Trump might not always perfectly coincide with evangelical beliefs. That's their political party. It's really about partisan identification at the end of the day, and that's the number one predictor of vote choice.
We have a call. Ted from Lansdowne joining us on Radio Times. And Ted, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Listen, my simple point is if Hillary Clinton could have done now what John F. Kennedy's team did in 1960 when they brought Johnson on board. He was a huge contender in that election, in the primaries. They brought him on board in 1960, and he helped to win the election. Kennedy only won by 100,000 votes. If she had done that to Sanders, and he accepted, assuming, I think the whole 13 million voters would have walked over gladly. She got the gold. He got the silver. And then they would have had a seat at the table, and it would have legitimized their movement. But instead, she basically is afraid. She should have read Doris Kearns Goodwin's A Team of Rivals, which I'm reading right now.
Yeah, in fact, Doris Kearns.
Yes, yeah. They might have disagreed on a few points. So what?
Well, each president or each presidential nominee gets to make this decision, whether you like it or not. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kyle, that was almost 60 years ago. Are there lessons from that vice presidential pick?
Sure. So let me start with the LBJ analysis. And actually, we have a whole chapter in our book devoted to this. And believe it or not, it's largely a myth. the fact that LBJ delivered Texas or the South, whenever we dig into the data on this, we were able to get survey data from 1960 from the University of Michigan, nationally representative sample of voters across the United States. Actually, what we find is that voters have an increasingly negative opinion of Lyndon Johnson the closer they get to Texas. Now, that sounds really counterintuitive given what we know as the conventional wisdom that Johnson delivered the South, but he wasn't exceptionally popular in Texas or the South. In many ways, he was viewed as a turncoat on civil rights for helping to push through the 57 Civil Rights Act whenever he was in leadership in the United States Senate. And even some internal campaign polls that we obtained from the Kennedy and Johnson's libraries suggest that Kennedy was just as popular as Lyndon Johnson in the South, if not more popular in both Texas and Louisiana. And we go to great lengths to analyze all these data sets, and ultimately we come up short in terms of any evidence suggesting that Lyndon Johnson swayed a significant number of voters.
Well,
and to the point about Sanders being a And to the point of Sanders being on the ticket, too, it would be an interesting combination. But also, we have to realize the vice president has to work with the president on a daily basis now for at least 4 to 8 years. Given the really combative primary between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, there might be some bad blood between them, to say the least. I'm not sure what type of daily working relationship that would result in if they were to be in the White House together.
Kyle, we're almost out of time here, and it sounds like your phone is just about to die on us. One quick question to you. What does Tim Kaine have to do later this week when he speaks at the convention?
I think he has to just deliver a positive message, a message that resonates with what Hillary Clinton is going to say the next night. So anything that he can do to help reinforce the party message and frame Hillary Clinton as the best choice in the 2016 presidential race, that's his job.
Kyle Kopko, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
All right. Thank you much.
You're very welcome. Associate professor at Elizabethtown College co-authored a book called The VP Advantage. And we began our conversation talking with Jim Nolan from the Richmond Times-Dispatch about this guy, Tim Kaine, of course, named by Hillary Clinton to be her sidekick, if I can put it that way. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We got another guest. He's sitting across from me, and we'll be talking to him in just a couple of minutes. Malcolm Kenyatta here from Philadelphia. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on Radio Row at the Democratic National Convention. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting across from Malcolm Kenyatta. He's a North Philadelphia community advocate, a delegate for Hillary Clinton at the DNC. He's a member engagement coordinator at the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce and a member of the board of directors of the Liberty City LGBT Democratic Club. And Malcolm Kenyatta, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. And talk about a cool place, Radio Row.
There you go. We love being on Radio Row. Let me just give out the phone number to our listeners, and it's 1-888-477-9499. We are being serenaded. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Malcolm, when did you become a Hillary Clinton supporter?
So back in 2008, it was my first election. I was actually a little bit young to vote in the primary.
How old were you in 2008?
So I was 17, so I was too young to vote in the primary, but I was very, very supportive, knocking on doors, making phone calls. And I was in college at the time, so, you know, having all those very rambunctious debates between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and I think that ultimately it turned out the way it was supposed to, and I think it worked out really well. No, he has been an amazing president. Golly, he's going to go down, you know, in the record books in a big way. And I think their partnership is one of the most dynamic political partnerships that we've ever seen. And also, if you look at Hillary Clinton, she is so much more, I think, like, settled in herself, having been Secretary of State. I think something happens when you become a grandparent, too. I really fundamentally do. She's just settled. She's like, this is who I am. I'm picking Tim Kaine, and I'm going to be president.
Well, that's so interesting. Now, you got something you said about your delegates, so you had to get votes.
I did.
How many did you get?
So just under 82,000, the second most of anybody who ran for delegate in the entire state, and the most of any male. So good stuff.
You go. Well, how did you do that? How did you get 82,000 votes?
From your mouth to God's ears, I have no idea.
Knocking on doors, obviously.
Well, you know, it's going out, knocking on doors. It's talking to people. And really, this is beyond one thing Bernie Sanders said last night that I think we can all agree on. This is not about one candidate. This is about moving forward on the big issues that matter. That's why these debates are so passionate, okay? Families fight. They fight hard. They fight tough. But this is not picking what we're going to eat today, right? This is deciding whether or not some people are going to be able to eat, okay, and be able to take care of their families in a real way. And so we've been figuring out that process. And I will tell you, I had a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters vote for me as a delegate, even as they voted for Bernie Sanders. Absolutely. Because they recognize that we care about the same issues. What we're fighting over is the directions to get there.
Do you think the protesters are getting too much attention? We've talked to them. We've had them on our show. They clearly are opposed to Hillary Clinton. Yep. Some going so far as to calling for her to get locked up and calling her a criminal.
Did Donald Trump send some supporters here?
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You see some parallels between the Donald Trump supporters who in Cleveland did some of the same things or said some of the same things about Hillary Clinton?
Let's go to your first point.
Okay.
I do think that we're, I don't want to say we're overblowing it because there are very big conversations about big issues, right? And we're going to continue to have those conversations. But if you go out into the hall and to allude to Ted Cruz, who I don't like very much, but who did one good thing in Cleveland, he said, you know, to the New York delegation, he's like, I appreciate your enthusiasm. And very much the same thing. We appreciate the enthusiasm of some of the California delegation. And so the cameras stayed in the California delegation. But I would say tonight as the convention comes on, come down to the Pennsylvania delegation, watch Bernie Sanders supporters, Hillary supporters, excited about moving our country forward and also excited about beating this demagogue. I fundamentally believe that this isn't just any old election. This is an election about the fight for a soul of our country, and we have to win. And we can't just win. We have to win big to repudiate the disgusting rhetoric that we've seen on the other side.
Should people vote their conscience, whatever it is?
Well, if you are a progressive, then you always vote for progress. You always vote for moving us forward. And if that is your conscience, then you should be voting for Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton is a progressive and she has a line that we all love. She's a progressive that likes to get stuff done. And we're moving forward as a party. And one of the things that we don't talk about enough, Ezra Klein, really quick on Vox, talked about this. Hillary Clinton listened. And that has been seen as a negative, but she listens. Look at that proposal around college that they put together. They listen to each other, and that's clear in the policy.
What do you think, and of course we've had 8 years of Barack Obama. We're here in Philadelphia. You've been working hard in North Philadelphia to try to address some of the challenges, the problems in some of the communities up there. Has Barack Obama been good for Philadelphia, and do you think Hillary Clinton can be good for Philadelphia?
Barack Obama has been good for America. He's been good for Philadelphia. He's been good for all of us. But the fact of the matter is, and he knows this very well, and I'm sure he'll talk about this a bit on Wednesday, the progress has been not widespread enough. So I'm so happy to have everybody here in Philadelphia. This is, I often like to say, I'm from the best part of the best city in the world. You go around Center City, you see cranes everywhere, you see a lot of construction, you see things moving. We have the Pope here, now we have the DNC. A lot of great things are happening here. But come to North Philly, and you'll see in some cases a tale of two cities. And so we have to, the question is, how do we make this prosperity broad base? How do we move it outside of just Center City and make sure that's touching everybody?
Well, I happen to agree with you. I think the biggest challenge, not just facing the Democratic Party, but the country, is how we address the growing disparity between rich and poor.
We have to figure it out.
And how do we do that? I mean, from your experience in this part of the city.
So this is
and
the
I should say to our listeners, of the top 10 big cities in this country, Philadelphia has the highest rate of poverty, just to underscore what we're talking about.
Absolutely. It's one of the distinctions that we have that I am not proud of. We do. And a lot of that poverty is concentrated right in North Philly, where I'm from. It's the heart of our city. And we have right now about 250,000 plus people that are living in poverty or deep poverty. That in that type of toxic stress, not knowing where your next meal is going to come from, not knowing if you're going to have heat in the winter and air in the summer, that's not who we are, and we really have to figure that out. And I think the platform lays out one of the best ways to do it. What we know is that more and more women are the primary breadwinners in their homes, and we have a lot of people, specifically in North Philly, who are working jobs, and they are not being paid fairly. A state rep, my state rep Thomas, he says something all the time that I fundamentally agree with. $7.25 is nothing but an invitation to rob somebody. We need to get people money that they can take care of their family. These people aren't asking to be rich. They aren't asking to build some fake empire like Donald Trump. They want to take care of their families. They want to take care of their kids. That is what they're asking for, and they're demanding it, and we have to do it. There is a moral argument to make for this, but there's an economic argument. When we give people, especially people that are on the lower end of the scale, when we're talking economically, those people put that money right back in the economy. It was one of the reasons George Bush sent out those checks, right? And that money went right back in the economy. People aren't hiding their money under the bed. They're buying toilet tissue and napkins and food for their family.
That's Malcolm Kenyatta, our final guest in this morning's edition of Radio Times, again on Radio Row at the Democratic National Convention here in South Philadelphia. He's a North Philadelphia community advocate. He is a delegate for Hillary Clinton. He's also a is member engagement coordinator at the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce, a member of the board of directors at the Liberty City LGBT Democratic Club. And I do want to read some comments. I do want to ask you, though, we're here in Philadelphia, and obviously the platform coming from the Democratic Party,
most progressive in history,
very different from the one that came out of Cleveland, especially related to LGBTQ issues. Your response to just the, I guess, the disparity that you might see there.
I'm not even sure if we can call that a platform. That is a deranged rant of crazy people. Would you look at what we saw in Cleveland? Donald Trump was already bad enough on his own. But to see that pick of Mike Pence, the most anti-LGBT, maybe politician in history, who doesn't think that LGBT people can love who they love and get pizza, for God's sakes, but him and Donald Trump can kiss on stage. So I don't know. They might not be able to get pizza in Indiana.
We will find out. Let me read a couple of tweets here and comments. We got a tweet from Thaddeus.
Here we go.
The Democratic Party hasn't changed in that the progressive wing gets fear and threats, and the conservative side gets significant representation. So, I mean, clearly the Democratic Party has its work cut out for it. It will win over some of these reluctant supporters, but obviously not everyone.
Well, I think one of the things that has been a little frustrating with me with during this campaign, we are supporting different candidates. We're not supporting different policies. Nobody's in the hall saying, like what Donald Trump is saying, get rid of the Department of Education. Hillary's saying debt-free college. Bernie's saying free college. We figured out a way in the middle. Bernie Sanders has done some great things, and one of the things that he's done, I think, is make it not as faux pas, right, to be a progressive. You talked about raising the minimum wage maybe two years ago. People are like, absolutely not. You're going to destroy jobs, shut down the conversation. Now we can move forward and have that conversation, and I agree with him on that issue. But one of the things that we didn't hear in Bernie Sanders, I think, throughout this campaign was specifics. And that's where he falls short. He fell short on specifics, which is why I'm with Hillary Clinton, because at the end of the day, we need a plan. And so I say all that to say, just because you support Bernie Sanders, you don't own the progressive movement. There are tons of people that are voting for Hillary Clinton that have been out in the trenches fighting for progressive change for years. So, Thaddeus, I want you to get on board and vote for Hillary Clinton.
An email from Sheila. I so wish that the coverage of this DNC convention would reflect the Hillary supporters and detractors proportionately. The media keeps repeating the same negative comments of the minority over and over and over again, making it seem like they represent the majority. Yes, the protesters are getting too much attention, kind of agreeing with what you said earlier.
Okay, well, the check is in the mail, Sheila.
What about turnout? And just for people that don't know Pennsylvania or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania considered a battleground state. Philadelphia, pretty true blue, a pretty democratic, very democratic city. But
smart,
there is this question of turnout. Will people turn out in the fall in November?
People are going to turn out all over this country because they're sick of the status quo. They are sick of not being able to take care of their families. They're sick of our education system being in shambles. They're sick of the divisive language on the other side that wants to pit all the blame for some of the challenges that we face on people that don't look like us or people that weren't born here. That is not who we are. This election, again, I just repeat it over and over. This is not about, I wish it was, but this is not a policy election. We're arguing about 5% versus 10% on taxes or something. Donald Trump has zero plans. What he has is hate and an inability to brand things and use other people's money to do it. Hillary Clinton has a plan, but what we know is that she has experienced some of the worst attacks over a number of years, and I think people understate that. People want to say, oh, yeah, she's been attacked, but that's not why people don't like her. That's completely false. I mean, I've run campaigns. You give me $1 billion, and you pick a target, and I'm sure we can make people believe whatever we want them to believe about that person. As Michelle Obama said last night, she could have hung up her cleats, said, I'm going to go home. I've had a phenomenal career. I have a grandkid. I'm going to do that and go around and just, you know, advocate for things I like. But she gets back in the fight.
I was reading a little bit about you, a little bit about your background. You come from a pretty politically active family.
I do. My grandfather was Muhammad Kenyatta. He ran for mayor against Frank Rizzo in 75.
Wow.
And did a variety of other things. And he was an amazing, amazing man. He died when I was very, very young. But obviously, some of that still rubbed off, eh?
Absolutely. And how about your parents?
So my dad has passed. My dad was a social worker, so he cared about that aspect. But he wasn't a...
And a stickler for language, right?
Oh, my gosh. So I'll tell you, we would be on the bus. And my dad, people we don't know, fixing their verbiage. I'm like, Dad, please leave them alone.
Was that embarrassing for you?
Oh, mortifying. I'm like, please leave him alone, Dad. But no, he couldn't. This was who he was, and he's going to do it. And my mom, an amazing woman. Sometimes I'm like, let's have her run the economy, because she would take $100 and feed me and my brothers and sisters. I don't know how she did it. I don't know till this day. So if you want to get this economy really, really working, we need to put moms in charge of it.
I had a mom like that as well, I have to say. We recycled everything in our house. I have
I don't
everything
know how
at a double or triple use. Why are you so optimistic? There's so much sort of gloom and doom and pessimism afloat in the land, if I can put it that way. Where does your optimism come from?
Being cynical is easy. It's easy to look at the challenges we face. It's easy to look at North Philly. And if you Google North Philly, you know what will pop up? It'll be stories about our destruction, our decay, our decline. The story of America, though, has always been about us fighting, pushing back, making that more perfect union. And a lot of times, it's really messy. We had a civil war that we don't talk about. It's really, really messy sometimes. But we figure it out. We come together and we keep moving forward. I'm inspired by the people I see on my block who are living with, in some cases, third world level poverty. But they're not giving up. There's a woman on my block right now. She's selling water, ice, and pretzels on the step because she needs some extra money. She's not crying, saying, woe is me. She's not asking the government to give her a handout. What people want is an opportunity and a chance, and we're not giving them that.
When are you going to run for office?
I'm not running for office. I'm running away from people asking me that question.
You get that question a lot, right?
I'm getting it from you.
Yeah, but you're saying no, not now, not ever?
Well, you know what? My batting average at predicting the future is pretty low, and that's the only sports metaphor I had, so please don't go down this road. So I have no idea what's going to happen, but I'm here today, and I'm going to be here all week and until November, fighting for Hillary Clinton, telling the truth about her record. I'll shut up. When I hear people say, again, Hillary Clinton is not progressive, I want them to tell me what's not progressive about getting 8 million kids health care. You tell me that.
We're going to end on that note. Malcolm Kenyatta, thank you so much.
Here on Radio Row. I love it.
By Radio Row, which is where we are all week here in Philadelphia.
Thank you so much for
joining us today on Radio Times. Member, engagement coordinator at the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce and a member of the board of directors of the Liberty City LGBT Democratic Club and a delegate here at the convention, a supporter of Hillary Clinton. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. I have a lot of people to thank. Susan Green. Greenbaum and Madison Poulter and Nick Kowalski and Kevin Griffin up at WHYY. Adam Staniszewski down here at Radio Row. Also Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.